Greetings, special people. This is Keith Toller, bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the last show of the year. Welcome to the last day of the year. I'm still going to keep rocking the Christmas theme for one more show. This one is called The House of the Seven Santas Christmas Story, and it's written by John Kendrick Bangs. This was published in 1912. For once, the Weather Bureau had scored a good, clean hit. The bullseye was pierced squarely in the middle, and the promised blizzard falling upon the city at noon held the metropolis completely in its grip. Everything in the line of public transportation in and out of the town was tied up so tightly that it did not seem possible that it would ever be unraveled again. The snow was piling waist high upon the streets, and the cutting winds played their fantastic pranks with a chill and cruel persistence. It was with great difficulty that Dobley made his way into the Grand Central Railway Station. Like other suburban commuters at Christmas time, he was heavily laden with bundles of one kind and another. He fairly oozed packages. They stuck out of the pockets of his heavy ulster, a half dozen fastened together with a heavy cord he carried in his right hand, and some were slung about his shoulders and held there by means of a leathern strap. The real truth was that Dobley had been either too busy or had forgotten the wise resolutions of the autumn and had failed to do his Christmas shopping early, with the result that now, on Christmas Eve, he was returning to the little Dobleys with a veritable Santa Claus pack, whose contents were designed to delight their eyes in the early hours of the coming morning. "Fierce night, Hawkins," he said as he readjusted his packages. "I shall be glad enough to get home." The old man shook his head dubiously. "Well, I'm afraid you won't enjoy that luxury tonight, Mr. Dobley," he said. "We haven't been able to get a train out of here since 1 o'clock, and the way things look now, there won't be any business at this stand for 24 hours, even if we have luck."
"What's that?" returned Dobley.
You don't mean to say—"
"No trains out tonight, sir," said the doorman. "The line's out of commission from here to Buffalo, anyhow, and nobody knows what's going on west of there. The wires are down, and we're completely shut off from the world."
Dobley gave a long, low whistle. "By Jove, Hawkins," he muttered ruefully. "That's tough."
"Kind of hard on the kiddies, eh?"
said the old doorman sympathetically. "Mighty hard," said Dobley, with a catch in his voice. No chance of anything, not even a freight?" he went on anxiously.
"Couldn't pull a feather through with 30 locomotives, was the disheartening response. "I guess it's the hotel for yours tonight, sir."
Dobley turned away and pondered deeply for a few moments. Taking care of himself for the night was not, under the circumstances, a very difficult proposition, for his club was not far away, so that he was not confronted with the uncomfortable prospect of sleeping on the benches of the railway station. But the idea of the little Dobleys not finding their treasures awaiting them on the morrow, to say nothing of the anxiety of Mrs. Dobley over his non-arrival, was, to say the least, disconcerting. "Oh, well," he said philosophically, after going over the pros and cons of the situation carefully, "what's the use of worrying? What must be, and I'll have to make, the best of it." He buttoned his heavy coat up snugly around his neck, and seizing his bundles with a firmer grip, wished the old doorman a good night, and went out again into the storm. 15 minutes later, looking more like a snowman than an ordinary human being, he entered the club, and, if it be true that misery finds comfort in company, he was not doomed to go without consolation. There were 5 other fellow sufferers here trying to make the best of it.
"Well, hello, Dobby," cried his friend and neighbor, Grantham. "What happened to you, an 18-carat family man spending his Christmas Eve at the club? Well, shame on you."
"I am duly repentant, Gran," replied Dobley. "But, you see, as your neighbor, I felt it my duty to keep an eye on you this night. There are hobgoblins in the air. Why are you not at home in the bosom of your family yourself?"
"Well, the walking is too bad," said Grantham. "And besides, that confounded valet of mine forgot to put my snowshoes in my suitcase."
"Well, they say the river is frozen solid all the way up," put in Billy Ricketts, who is a good deal of a wag, as all old bachelors are apt to be. "Well, why don't you fellas skate home?"
"Well, I tried it," smiled Grantham, "but the wind is blowing down the river, and I live up. I haven't been going more than 2 hours when I landed on Staten Island."
In this way, the exiles strove to comfort each other, and on the surface succeeded, but inwardly a very miserable lot they were. Clubs have their attractions, but we have not yet succeeded in developing an institution of that kind which is a fair substitute for the home fireside on a Christmas Eve. Even the most confirmed old bachelor will confess to you that, way down deep in his heart, the comforts of such organization seems cheerless and cold in contrast to the visions of smiling hearthstones and merry gatherings of happy children that come to them in their dreams.
"You've got some bundle there, Dobby," said Grantham, as Dobley relieved himself of his burden of packages. "What are you going to do, open a department store?"
"Heh," ejaculated Ricketts. "You're a fine fellow to talk. Ought to have seen Gran when he staggered in here an hour ago, Dobby. I thought at first he was a branch office of the American Express Company. Honest, I did. Talk about your bundle trust. Gran had the market cornered."
"Well, why shouldn't I have?" demanded Grantham. "Haven't I got fine of the finest kids that ever climbed a Christmas tree?"
"Nope," said Dobley, with an air of conviction. "Your five are dandies, Gran, but you ought to see my six."
"Oh, I've seen 'em," said Grantham, "and I'll give every blessed one of them honorable mention as high steppers and thoroughbreds. But when it comes to the real thing, well, my five are blue ribbon kids, all right, all right."
"How you fathers do brag about little things," snorted Ricketts. "You two braggarts can roll your 11 into one, and the aggregate wouldn't be a marker to what my children would be, if I had any. I've half a mind to give up my state of single blessedness just to show you vainglorious chaps what—"
Just what Ricketts was going to show the assembled gathering in the world, we'll never be able to do more than guess, for he was not permitted to finish the sentence. It was at this precise point that Dr. Mallerby, shedding snow from his broad, burly figure at every step, staggered into the room and, with a scant greeting to his friends, hastened to the blazing log fire on the club hearth, and kneeling before it, began unwrapping a bundle of some size that he, too, carried in his arms.
"What on earth do you have there, Doctor?"
cried Ricketts, craning his neck over the newcomer's shoulder.
"One of those new character dolls?"
"Nope, Billy. No," said Mallerby, fumbling away at the bundle. "I wish to heaven it were. Can't you see, old man? It's the real thing."
"The real what?" said Ricketts, bending over.
"The real thing," returned Mallerby in a low voice. "A poor little tot of a newsboy."
"Well, where on earth did you pick him up?" gasped Ricketts, as the others gathered round.
"Oh, out of the storm," said Mallerby. "I found him huddled up in the vestibule of Colonel Mortimer's when I came out of the house 10 minutes ago. The poor little devil was curled up almost into a knot trying to keep warm, and lay there fast asleep with his papers under his arm. I honestly believe that if I hadn't come out when I did, it would have been too late. Oh, this is a fierce storm."
He isn't frozen, is he?"
faltered Dobley, as he gazed into the blue little face of the unconscious urchin, a face grimy with the frequent mixture of two dirty little fists and his tears.
"Well, not quite,"
said Mallerby. "I think I got him in time, and he'll pull through, but he had a mighty close call of it. By George, boys, just think of a wee bit of a tot like that, barely more than 6 years old, having to be out on a night like this. Why, the poor little cuss ought to be dreaming of Santa Claus and a nice warm bed somewhere, instead of picking pennies out of these Arctic streets of ours in order to keep body and soul together." Warmed by the glow of the fire, the youngster stirred as the doctor spoke, and a weary little voice, scarce higher than a whisper, broke the stillness of the room.
"Extry! Biggest blizzard in 20 years, extry paper, sir!"
The seven sophisticated men of the world gathered about the prostrate figure, stood silently, and three of them turned away, lest the others should see the unmanly moisture of their eyes.
"Here, by thunder," gasped Ricketts, pulling out a roll of bills from his pocket. "Hanged if I won't buy the whole edition."
"That's all right, Billy," smiled the doctor. "What he needs just now is something less cold than money. We'll take him upstairs and give him a warm bath, fill his little stomach up with milk, and put him to bed with a nice fuzzy blanket to thaw out his icy little legs."
"Well, splendid," said Ricketts. "But see here, doctor, I want to be in on this. Isn't there anything I can do to help?"
"Yes," said the doctor. "You might make this proceeding regular by putting him up as your guest on a 10-day card." The little bundle of rags and humanity was tenderly carried to the regions above, and under the almost womanly ministrations of Dr. Mallerby, was completely restored to cleanliness and warmth. What hunger he might have been conscious of was assuaged by a great bumper of milk, and then, in the most sumptuous apartment the club was able to provide, the thawed-out little gamin was put to bed. The snowy sheets, the soft downy pillows, and the soul-warming blankets were not needed to lure him into the land of dreams, for the bitter experiences of the earlier hours of the night still weighed heavily upon his lids, even if his mind and heart were no longer conscious of them. He presented a most appealing picture as he lay there. After settling back with a deep-drawn sigh of content into the kindly embrace of a bed 7 or 8 sizes too big for him, his little legs scarcely reaching halfway to the middle, and his tousled head of red hair forming a rubricated spot on the milk-white pillowcase as it stuck up out of the bedclothes, he lay comfortably back in what was probably the first soft nest it had known since it lay on its mother's breast, if, indeed, it had ever known that rare felicity.
"There," said the doctor, as the little foundling, with a suspicion of a smile on his pursed-up lips, wandered more deeply into the land of Nod.
"I guess he's fixed for the night, anyhow, and the rest of us can go about our business."
The seven men tiptoed softly out of the room, and adjoined to the spacious chambers below, where for an hour they tried to lose themselves in the chaos of bridge. They were all fairly expert players at that noble social obsession, but nobody would have guessed it that night. No party of beginners ever played quite so atrociously, and yet no partner was found sufficiently outraged to be acrimonious. The fact was that not one of them was able to keep his mind on the cards, the thoughts of every one of them constantly being drawn to the wan little figure in that upper room. Finally, Dobley, after having reneged twice and trumped his partner's trick more than once, threw down his cards and drew away from the table impatiently.
"Ah, it's no use, fellows," he said. "I can't keep my eye on the ball. I'm going to bed." "Same here," said Ricketts. "Every blessed face card in this pack, king, queen, or jack, is a red-headed little newsboy to me, and every spade is his heart. It's me for Slumberland."
So the party broke up, and within an hour the clubhouse went dark. Dr. Mallerby assumed possession of a single room adjoining that of their little guest, so that he might keep an eye on his newly acquired patient through the night. and the others distributed themselves about the upper floors. At midnight, all was as still as a sylvan dell in the depths of a winter's night, when no sounds of birds or of rustling leaves or of a babbling water break in upon the quiet of the scene. It was 3 o'clock in the morning when Dr. Mallerby was roused suddenly from his sleep by the sound of stealthy footsteps in the adjoining room where the little sleeper lay. He rose hastily from his couch and entered the room and was much surprised to see, in the dim light of the hall lamp, no less a person than Dobley, acting rather suspiciously, too. "Hello, what are you up to, Dobby?" he queried in a low whisper as he espied that worthy, clad in bathrobe of too ample proportions, stealing out of the room. "Nothing, Mallerby, nothing." replied Dobley, evidently much embarrassed. I just thought I'd run down and see how the little chap was getting along. I'm something of a father myself, you know. "What's all this?" continued the doctor, as his eye fell upon a number of strange-looking objects spread along the foot of the bed. Far beyond the reach of the little toes of the sleeper, a book of rhymes with a gorgeous red cover, a small tin trumpet, with a pleasing variety of stops, a box of tin soldiers, and a complete Rough Rider's outfit, sword, cap, leggings, and blouse, not to mention an assortment of other things well calculated to delight the soul of youth.
"Why," faltered Dobley,
his face turning as red as the flag of anarchy. "You see, I happen to have these things along with me, Mallerby, for my own kiddies, you know. And it sort of seemed a pity not to get some use out of them on Christmas morning, and so, you know, old man." The hand of the doctor gripped that of the intruder, and he tried to assure him that he did know, but he couldn't. He choked up and was about to turn away when the door began moving slowly upon its hinges once more, and Grantham entered, quite as much after the fashion of the stealthy-footed criminal as Dobley. He, too, carried a variety of packages, and under each arm was a tightly packaged golf stocking. He started back as he saw Dobley and the doctor standing by the bedside, but it was too late. They had caught him in the act.
"Ah, Grantham," said Dobley with a grin, "giving an imitation of a second-story man, eh? What are you going to do with those two stuffed clubs? Sandbag somebody?"
"Yes," said Grantham sheepishly. "I've had it in for the doctor for some time now, and I thought I'd sneak down and give him one while he slept."
"It's all right."
"All right, Granny," smiled the doctor. "Just hang your clubs on the foot of the bed there, and after I've got to sleep again, come in and perpetuate the dastardly deed."
"Fact is, boys," said Grantham seriously, "these things I was taking home to my youngsters are going to waste under the circumstances, and I had an idea it wouldn't hurt our guest here to wake up just once to a real Santa Claus feast."
"Fine," said the doctor. "Looks to me as if this youngster had thrown doubles. Dobby here has already fitted him out with a complete army, and various other things, too numerous to mention."
"Why, look who's here," cried Dobley, interrupting the doctor as the door swung open a third time. And Seymour appeared, his raiment consisting of a blanket and a pair of carpet slippers, causing him, in the dim light, to give the impression of an Indian on the warpath.
"By Jove, Tommy," he added, "all you need is a tomahawk in one hand and a bunch of wooden cigars in the other to pass for the puller in of a tobacco shop. What are you after, sneaking in here like old Sitting Bull, at this unholy hour of the morning, after the kid's scalp?"
"Why, you see, Dobby," replied Seymour, revealing a soft furry cap and a pair of gloves that looked as if they had just been pulled off the paws of a bear cub. "I happen to be taking these things home for my boy Jim. He's daft on skating, and it's cold as Dickens up at Blairsport, but Jimmy can wait until New Year's for his, I guess.
It came over me all of a sudden while I was trying to get to sleep upstairs that our honored guest might find them, well, useful.
"Look at those chap little fists," said the doctor. "That's your answer, Seymour."
"They're his, all right," said Seymour, sitting on the side of the bed and comparing the gloves with the red little hands that lay inert on the counterpane.
"By Jove," he muttered, as he took one of the diminutive hands in his own. "Well, they're like sandpaper."
"Well, selling papers in winter doesn't give these little babies exactly the sort of paddies you'd expect to find on a mollycoddle," said the doctor. And so, here in the house of the Seven Santas, things went for the next hour. One by one, all the prisoners of the night, with the exception of Ricketts, dropped in surreptitiously to find the idea of each were common to them all. And the little mite, under the bedclothes, was destined soon to emerge from the riches of his dreams into a reality even richer and more substantial. The varied gifts were ranged about the foot of the bed. The golf stockings, bulging with sweets, were hung at its head, and the big-hearted donors retired, this time to that real sleep that comes to him who has had the satisfaction of some kindly deed to look back upon.
"Poor Ricketts," sighed the doctor, as he noted the one absentee. "How much these old bachelors lose at this time of the year."
2 hours later, just as the first rays of the dawn began to light up the guest room, its small occupant opened his eyes and began rubbing them violently with his fists.
"Gee," was his first utterance, and then he sat up and gazed about him. Its unfamiliar surroundings naturally puzzled him, and a look of childish wonder came over his face.
"Where am I at?" he muttered. "Guess this must be the heaven place these guys down at the mission talk about."
He clambered out of bed, and as he did so, his eyes took in the wondrous array of gifts spread out before him.
"Well, what do you know about that?" he muttered. "What kind of joint is this, anyhow?"
As he attempted to walk across the room, his small feet became entangled in the flowing skirt of Mallerby's bathrobe, which he wore in lieu of a nightshirt.
"That's it," he said as he tripped and stumbled to the floor. "I'm dead. That's what I am. And these is my angel clothes. Ha! Gee, but they's hard to walk in. Seems to me I'd rather have me pants."
In a moment he had regained his feet, and the marvelous variety of toys began to reveal themselves in detail to his astonished vision.
"Well, will your pipe dad lay out?" he gasped ecstatically. "Ha! Wonder what kid's going to have the luck to draw them into his socks."
And just then the door opened again, and a sleepy-eyed old bachelor came stealing in the person of Ricketts. He wore his pajamas and a yellow Macintosh thrown over his shoulders.
"Well, good morning, kitty," he said, closing the door softly behind him. "Merry Christmas to you."
"Merry Christmas yourself," smiled the youngster. "Say, mister, can you tell me where I'm at? This ain't like my regular lodging house, and I must have got in a wrong somehow."
"Where is your regular lodging house?" asked Ricketts, seating himself on the side of the bed.
"Oh, any old place where there's room for me and my feet at the same time," replied the boy. "Packing boxes mostly into winter time, and the docks into summer."
But your parents," demanded Ricketts. "Where are they?"
"Me what?"
asked the boy.
"Your parents, your father and mother," explained Ricketts.
"I ain't never had no mother," said the boy. "But me father, well, me and him had a scrap over wages last summer, and I ain't seen him since."
"Your wages, eh?" smiled Ricketts.
The idea of this little tad earning wages struck him as being rather humorous.
"Yeah, he thought I ought to give him the whole wad," said the boy. "When he kicked me out for spending a nickel on myself and a friend of mine last 4th of July, well, he gave me the skidoo."
"I see," said Ricketts,
regarding the little boy with a singular light in his eye.
"You've got a fine lot of stuff here from old Santa Claus, haven't you?"
"What, me?"
asked the boy, gazing earnestly into Ricketts' face.
Is these things here for me?
Well, why, of course, said Rickett. Old Daddy Santa Claus is on his rounds last night, found you occupying a handsome apartment on Fifth Avenue. But the steam heat had been turned off, and, fearing you might catch cold, he picked you up and brought you to his own home. He'd been looking for you all day.
And these is, really? For me?
Cried the child. Every blessed stick and shred of them, said Ricketts fervently. The boy squatted flat on the floor, completely staggered by the sudden revelation of his wealth.
Whoochee,
was all he could think of to say. And then began a romp through a veritable toyland in which two lonely wanderers through the vales of life had the first taste of joys they had never known before. The red-headed little son of the street getting the first glimpse of kindness that his starved little soul had ever enjoyed. The confirmed old bachelor finding the only outlet that fate had ever vouchsafed him for those instincts of fatherhood which are the priceless heritage of us all. Small wonder that the play waxed fast, furious, and noisy. The lad, up to this time confronted ever with the pressing necessities of life, developed a capacity for play that was all the more intense for the privations of his limited years. The bachelor, finding the dam of his pent-up feelings loosened into an overwhelming flood of pure joyousness. There were cries of joy and shrieks of laughter, and when, with some difficulty because of his lack of experience, Ricketts finally succeeded in getting the lad arrayed in his Rough Rider suit, whose buckles and buttons seemed aggravatingly small for hands that had developed nothing but thumbs, the tin trumpet with all the stops save the one that would silence it even temporarily was brought into play, and the battles that were fought in the ensuing hour between the noble army of warriors, led by the younger against himself as either a Spanish army or a wild Indian tribe, have no equals in the annals of warfare. The morning was pretty well advanced when the other sleeping Santas were roused from their dreams by the shouts of victory, to be confronted upon investigation by a prostrate enemy in the person of Ricketts lying face downward upon the floor with the diminutive Rough Rider standing upon the small of his back, waving a nickel sword in the air while he blew ear-splitting blasts upon his trumpet to announce the arrival of the conqueror.
"Well, well, well," said Dr. Mallerby with a loud laugh, and he and the others burst into the room. "What's going on? Another San Juan Hill?"
The same, panted Ricketts from his coign of disadvantage. And I'm the hill. All that remains now is for some of you fellows to hurry up and get a bath towel from somewhere and hoist a flag of truce.
The morning passed, and the storm showing some signs of abatement, the exiled men began to cherish hopes of getting home before night. Communication with the railway station elicited the gratifying news that about 4 o'clock in the afternoon a train would be sent forth to carry the marooned suburbanites back to the scene of their domestic desires. Meanwhile, the honored guest received to the full all the attention of which the seven Santas were capable. Only in making up for the lost playtime of the past, the guest proved to be untiring. Well, the seven Santas were compelled now and then to work in relays to order to keep up with the game. Hence it was that at various hours of the day, dignified businessmen were to be seen squatting upon the floor, irrespective of that dignity, running iron cars over the tin railway tracks, arranging the settled ranks of tin soldiers in battle array, answering strident summonses to battle sounded on that everlasting tin trumpet, and, strange to say, joining their young friend in feasts of candy and other digestion-destroying sweets, which they had forever eschewed long years before.
"Well, I suppose I'll suffer for this," said Grantham, as at the command of his superior officer he swallowed the handful of peppermint walking stick, and Fletcherizing it carefully for several minutes. "But by ginger, it's worth it."
"You'll be all right, Gran," laughed the doctor.
If worse comes to worse, I'll blow you a pony of epicrack, unless you prefer squills. But at last, even the strenuous nature of the guest began to show signs of the day's inroads upon his strength. And when the hour for the departure of the suburbanites came shortly before 4, and they all gathered around to bid him their adieus, they were hardly surprised to find him curled up on the bearskin rug before the fire, fast asleep, with his tin trumpet hugged tightly to his breast.
"We're a great lot," said Dobley suddenly. "We can't all go off and leave him here alone. What the dickens are we going to do?"
"Well, don't bother," said Ricketts from the depths of the lounge, where he'd been trying for some minutes to get a much-needed rest. "I haven't anything on hand. Boys, leave him to me. I'll take care of him."
"I move we all meet here tomorrow," said Grantham, "and see what's to be done with the kid."
Ricketts rose up from the lounge and started to speak, but was interrupted by the doctor.
"Did any of you think to ask the little tad his name?" he required.
"That's where I come in, boys," said Ricketts. "You needn't bother your heads about his name or his tomorrow. I'll take care of both.
You men have provided him with the joys of today. Pretty substantial joys, too, as those of us who have helped him to enjoy them can testify. As the heartless old bachelor, bundleless and forlorn, I was unable to qualify on the toy end of things, but when it comes to names, I'll give him one as my contribution to the Christmas possessions."
"Well, good for you, Billy," laughed Dobley.
"Would you mind telling us what it is to be, so that we can put him on our visiting lists?"
"Not in the least," returned Ricketts, with an affectionate glance at the boy. "He is to be known henceforth as William Ricketts, Jr."
"William Ricketts, Jr.," cried the others, almost in one voice.
"Precisely," said Ricketts, turning and facing them. "From now on, you fellows will have to quit putting it over on me because you have children and I haven't. I've come to a ready-made family, rather unexpectedly, but there it is. It's mine and I'm going to keep it. I've been without one too long, and after what I have tasted this day, I find that I have acquired a thirst for paternity and can never be cured of it. Tomorrow I propose to adopt our small guest here formally by due process of law."
"But where do we come in on this?" cried Grantham. "Oh, it's bully of you, old man, but we can't permit you to shoulder the whole burden of this boy's—"
"Shut up, Gran,"
retorted Ricketts with an affection of fine scorn.
"You and the rest of this bunch are nothing but a lot of blooming uncles. And by the way, gentlemen," he added with a courtly bow, "I thank you all from the bottom of my heart for your kindness to my son. Good night."
And with that, 6 of the exiles passed out into the twilight and hurried back to their own firesides, leaving Ricketts to his own. And that is why, too, that the club servants, when they came to make their rounds that night before turning out the lights, were surprised to find old Billy Ricketts lying fast asleep in the warm embrace of one of the richly upholstered armchairs of the lounging room, before the blazing log fire on the hearth, with a mite of a boy curled up in his lap, his little red head snuggled closely to the manly chest of the protector, and a happy little smile upon his lips that showed that his dreams were sweet, and that in those arms he felt himself secure from the trials of life. There was that upon the faces of both that gave the watchers pause, and they refrained from waking them, merely turning out the electric lights and tiptoeing softly out of the room, leaving the sleepers bathed in the mellow glow of the dancing flames. Two lonely hearts that had come into their own in the house of the 7 Santas.
Okie doke. Another story from the internet from MysteryNet.com. A story called The Thieves Who Couldn't Help Sneezing. This is written by Thomas Hardy. Many years ago, when oak trees now past their prime were about as large as elderly gentlemen's walking sticks, there lived in Wessex a yeoman's son whose name was Hubert. He was about 14 years of age and was as remarkable for his candor and lightness of heart as for his physical courage, of which indeed he was a little vain. One cold Christmas Eve, his father, having no other help at hand, sent him on an important errand to a small town several miles from home. He traveled on horseback and was detained by the business till a late hour in the evening. At last, however, it was completed. He returned to the inn, the horse was saddled, and he started on his way. His journey homeward lay through the Vale of Blackmoor, a fertile but somewhat lonely district, with heavy clay roads and crooked lanes. In those days, too, a great part of it was thickly wooded. It must have been about 9 o'clock when, riding along amid the overhanging trees upon his stout-legged cob, Jerry, and singing a Christmas carol to be in harmony with the season, Hubert fancied he heard a noise among the boughs. This recalled to his mind that the spot he was traversing bore an evil name. Men had been waylaid here. He looked at Jerry and wished he had been of any other color than light gray, for on this account the docile animal's form was visible even here in the dense shade.
"What do I care?" he said aloud, after a few minutes of reflection. "Jerry's legs are too nimble to allow any highwayman to come near me."
"Indeed!" was said in a deep voice, and the next moment a man darted from the thicket on his right hand, another man from the thicket on his left hand, and another from a tree trunk a few yards ahead. Hubert's bridle was seized, he was pulled from his horse, and though he struck out with all his might, as a brave boy would naturally do, he was overpowered. His arms were tied behind him, his legs bound tightly together, and he was thrown into the ditch. The robbers, whose faces he could now dimly perceive to be artificially blackened, at once departed, leading off the horse. As soon as Hubert had a little recovered himself, he found that by great exertion he was able to extricate his legs from the cord. But, in spite of every endeavor, his arms remained bound as fast as before. All, therefore, that he could do was to rise to his feet and proceed on his way with his arms behind him, and trust to chance for getting them unfastened. He knew that it would be impossible to reach home on foot that night, and in such condition, but he walked on. Owing to the confusion which his attack caused in his brain, he lost his way, and would have been inclined to lie down and rest till morning among the dead leaves had he not known the danger of sleeping without wrappers in a frost so severe. So he wandered further onwards, his arms wrung and numbed by the cord which pinioned him, and his heart aching for the loss of poor Jerry, who had never been known to kick or bite or show a single vicious habit. He was not a little glad when he discerned through the trees a distant light. Toward this he made his way, and presently found himself in front of a large mansion, with flanking wings, gables and towers, the battlements and chimneys showing their shapes against the stars. All was silent, but the door stood wide open, it being from this door that the light shone which had attracted him. On entering, he found himself in a vast apartment arranged as a dining hall and brilliantly illuminated. The walls were covered with a great deal of wainscoting, formed into molded panels, carvings, closet doors, and the usual fittings of a house of that kind. But what drew his attention most was the large table in the midst of the hall, upon which was spread a sumptuous supper, as yet untouched. Chairs were placed around, and it appeared as if something had occurred to interrupt the meal just at the time when all were ready to begin.
Even had Hubert been so inclined, he could not have eaten in his helpless state unless by dipping his mouth into the dishes like a pig or cow. He wished first to obtain assistance, and was about to penetrate further into the house for that purpose when he heard hasty footsteps to the porch and the words, "Be quick," uttered in the deep voice which had reached him when he was dragged from the horse. There was only just time for him to dart under the table before three men entered the dining hall. Peeping from beneath the hanging edges of the tablecloth, he perceived that their faces too were blackened, which at once removed any remaining doubts that he might have felt that these were the same thieves.
"Now then," said the first, the man with a deep voice, "let us hide ourselves. They will be back again in a minute. That was a good trick to get them out of the house, eh?"
"Yes, you well imitated the cries of a man in distress," said the second.
"Exactly," said the third.
"They will soon find out that it was a false alarm. Come, where shall we hide, then? It must be some place we can stay in for 2 or 3 hours till we are all in bed and asleep. Oh, I have it. Come this way. I have learnt that the further closet is not opened but once in a 12-month. It will serve our purpose exactly."
The speaker advanced into a corridor which led from the hall. Creeping a little further forward, Hubert could discern that the closet stood at the end, facing the dining hall. The thieves entered it and closed the door. Hardly breathing, Hubert glided forward to learn a little bit more of their intention, if possible, and coming close, he could hear the robbers whispering about the different rooms where the jewels, plate, and other valuables of the house were kept, which they plainly meant to steal. They had not been long in hiding when a gay chattering of ladies and gentlemen was audible on the terrace without. Hubert felt that it would not do to be caught prowling about the house unless he wished to be taken for a robber himself, and he slipped softly back to the hall, out the door, and stood in a dark corner of the porch, where he could see everything without being himself seen. In a moment or two, a whole troop of personages came gliding past him into the house. There were an elderly gentleman and lady, 8 or 9 young ladies, and many young men, besides half a dozen manservants and maids. The mansion had apparently been quite emptied of its occupants.
"Now, children and young people, we will resume our meal," said the old gentleman. "What the noise could have been, I cannot understand. I never felt so certain in my life that there was a person being murdered outside my door."
Then the ladies began saying how frightened they had been, and how they had expected an adventure, and how it had ended nothing at all.
"Wait a while," said Herbert to himself. "You'll have adventure enough by and by, ladies."
It appeared that the young men and women were married sons and daughters of the old couple who had come that day to spend Christmas with their parents. The door was then closed, Hubert being left outside in the porch. He thought this a proper moment for asking their assistance, and, since he was unable to knock with his hands, began boldly to kick the door.
"Hello, what disturbance are you making here?" said a footman who opened it,
and, seizing Herbert by the shoulder, he pulled him into the dining hall.
"Here's a strange boy I have found making a noise in the porch, Sir Simon."
Everybody turned.
"Bring him forward," said Sir Simon,
the old gentleman before mentioned.
"What were you doing there, me boy?"
Why, his arms are tied."
"Oh, poor fellow," said another.
Hubert at once began to explain that he had been waylaid on his journey home, robbed of his horse, and mercilessly left in his condition by the thieves.
"Well, only to think of it," exclaimed Sir Simon.
"This is a very likely story," said one of the gentleman guests incredulously.
"Doubtfully?" asked Sir Simon.
"Well, perhaps he's a robber himself," suggested a lady.
"There's a curious, wild, wicked look about him, certainly now that I examine him closely," said the old mother.
Hubert blushed with shame, and instead of continuing his story and relating that robbers were concealed in the house, he doggedly held his tongue and half resolved to let them find out their danger for themselves.
Well, untie him, said Sir Simon. Come, since it's Christmas Eve, we'll treat him well. Here, me lad, sit down in that empty seat at the bottom of the table and make as good a meal as you can. When you have had your fill, we will listen to your more particulars about your story.
The feast then proceeded, and Hubert, now at liberty, was not at all sorry to join in. The more they ate and drank, the merrier did the company become. The wine flowed freely, the logs flared up the chimney, the ladies laughed at the gentlemen's stories. In short, all went as noisily and as happily as a Christmas gathering in old times possibly could do. Hubert, in spite of his hurt feelings at their doubts of his honesty, could not help being warmed both in mind and in body by the good cheer, the scene, and the example of hilarity set by his neighbors. At last he laughed as heartily at their stories and repartees as the old baronet, Sir Simon himself. When the meal was almost over, one of the sons, who had drunk a little too much wine, after the manner of men in the country, said to Hubert, "Well, my boy, how are you? Can you take a pinch of snuff?" He held out one of the snuff-boxes, which were then becoming common among young and old throughout the country.
"Thank you," said Hubert, accepting a pinch.
"Tell the ladies who you are, what you're made of, and what you can do," the young man continued, slapping Hubert upon the shoulder.
"Certainly,"
said our hero, drawing himself up, and thinking it best to put a bold face on the matter.
"I am a travelling magician."
"Indeed?
What shall we hear next? Can you call up spirits from a vast, deep young wizard?" "I can conjure up a tempest in a cupboard,"
Hubert replied. "Ha, ha, ha!" said the old baronet pleasantly, rubbing his hands.
"We must see this performance. Girls, don't go away. Here is something to be seen."
"Oh, not dangerous, I hope," said the old lady.
Hubert rose from the table.
"Hand me your snuff-box, please," he said to the young man who had made free with him. "And now," he continued, "without the least noise, follow me. If any of you speak, it will break the spell."
They promised obedience. He entered the corridor, and taking off his shoes, went on tiptoe to the closet door, the guests advancing in a silent group at a little distance behind him. Hubert next placed a stool in front of the door, and by standing upon it was just tall enough to reach to the top. He then just as noiselessly poured all the snuff from the box along the upper edge of the door, and, with a few short puffs of breath, blew the snuff through the chinks into the interior of the closet. He held up a finger to the assembly that they might be silent.
"Oh, dear me, what's that?" said the old lady after a minute or two had elapsed.
A suppressed sneeze had come from inside the closet. Hubert held up his finger again.
"Well, how very singular," whispered Sir Simon. "This is most interesting."
Hubert took advantage of the moment and gently slid the bolt of the closet door into its place. "More snuff," he said calmly.
"More snuff," said Sir Simon.
Two or three gentlemen passed their boxes, and the contents were blown in at the top of the closet. Another sneeze, not quite so well suppressed as the first, was heard, then another, which seemed to say that it would not be suppressed under any circumstances whatever. At length there arose a perfect storm of sneezes.
"Well, excellent! Excellent for one so young," said Sir Simon. "I am much interested in this trick of throwing the voice, called what I believe a ventriloquism."
"More snuff," said Hubert.
"More snuff," said Sir Simon.
Sir Simon's man brought a large jar of the best scented scotch. Hubert once more charged the upper chink of the closet and blew the snuff into the interior as before. Again he charged, and again, emptying the whole contents of the jar. The tumult of sneezes became really extraordinary to listen to. There was no sensation. It was like wind, rain, and sea battling in a hurricane.
"I "'Believe there are men inside, and that this is no trick at all!'
exclaimed Sir Simon, the truth flashing on him.
"'There are,' said Hubert. "'They are come to rob the house, and they are the same who stole my horse.'
The sneezes changed to spasmodic groans. One of the thieves, hearing Hubert's voice, cried,
"'Oh, mercy, mercy, let us out of this!'
"'Where's my horse?' said Hubert.
Tied to the tree in the hollow behind Short's gibbet. Mercy, mercy, let us out, or we shall die of suffocation.
All the Christmas guests now perceived that this was no longer sport, but serious earnest. Guns and cudgels were produced. All the men servants were called in and arranged in a position outside the closet. At a single, Hubert withdrew the bolt and stood on the defensive. But the three robbers, far from attacking them, were found crouching in the corner, gasping for breath. They made no resistance, and being pinioned, were placed in an outhouse till morning. Hubert now gave the remainder of the story to the assembled company, and was profusely thanked for the services he had rendered. Sir Simon pressed him to stay over the night and accept the use of the best bedroom the house afforded, which had been occupied by Queen Elizabeth and King Charles successively when on their visit to this part of the country. But Hubert declined, being anxious to find his horse Jerry and to test the truth of the robbers' statements concerning him. Several of the guests accompanied Hubert to the spot behind the gibbet, alluded to by the thieves as where Jerry was hidden. When they reached the knoll and looked over, behold, there the horse stood, uninjured and quite unconcerned. At the sight of Hubert, he neighed joyfully, and nothing could exceed Hubert's gladness at finding him. He mounted, wished his friends good night, and cantered off in the direction they pointed out, reaching home safely about 4 o'clock in the morning. All right, and in the last few minutes, I'm going to read you a poem written by Howard D. Fensel. It's called The Last Christmas Tree. I saw a truck on Christmas... I saw a truck of Christmas trees, and each one had a tail. The driver stood them in a row and put them up for sale. He strung some twinkly lights and hung up a sign with a nail. Fresh Christmas trees, it said in red. Fresh Christmas trees for sale. He poured himself hot cocoa in a steaming thermos cup, and snowflakes started falling as a family car pulled up. A mom, a dad, and one small boy who looked no more than 3 jumped out and started searching for the perfect Christmas tree. The boy marched up and down the rows. The boy marched up and down the rows, his nose high in the air. It smells like Christmas, Mom. It smells like Christmas everywhere. Oh, let's get the biggest tree we can, a tree that's 10 miles high, a tree to go right through the roof, a tree to touch the sky, a tree so big that Santa Claus will stop and stare and say, now that's the finest Christmas tree I've seen this Christmas day. It seemed they looked at every tree at least 3 million times. Dad shook them, pinched them, turned them round to find the perfect pine. I found it, Mom, the Christmas tree I like the best of all. It's got a little bare spot, but we'll turn that to the wall. We'll put on Great Grandma's angel on top the highest bough. Oh, can we buy it? Please, Mom, please. Oh, can we buy it now?
How about some nice hot cocoa? Asked the man who owned the lot. He twisted off the thermos top. No, this will hit the spot.
He poured the steaming chocolate in 3 tiny paper cups. They toasted, here's to Christmas, and they drank the cocoa up.
Is this your choice? The tree man asked. This pine's the best one here.
The boy seemed sad. My daddy says the price is, just too dear.
Well, then Merry Christmas, said the man, who wrapped the tree in twine. It's yours for just one promise you must keep at Christmas time. On Christmas Eve at bedtime, as you fold your hands to pray, promise in your heart to keep the joy of Christmas Day.
Now hurry home, this freezy wind is turning your cheeks pink, and ask your dad to trim that trunk and give that tree a drink." And so it went on all that blustery eve, as the tree man gave tree upon tree upon tree, to every last person who came to the lot, who toasted with cocoa in small paper cups, who promised the promise of joy in their hearts, and singing out carols, drove off in the dark. And when it was over, one tree stood alone, but no one was there to give it a home. The tree man put on his red parka and hood and dragged the last Christmas tree out to the wood. He left the pine right by a stream in the cold so the wood's homeless creatures could make it their home. He smiled as he brushed off some snow from his beard when out of the thicket a reindeer appeared. He scratched that huge reindeer on top his huge head. "Well, it looks like we've started up Christmas again. There are miles more to travel and much more to do. Let's go home, my friend, and get started anew." He looked to the sky and heard jingle bells sound. And then, in a twinkling, the tree man was gone. Well, folks, just a few hours left on this year. I want to thank you for joining me throughout 2024 and blessing me by listening into the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here saying I hope you had a wonderful Christmas, a blessed Christmas. Have a happy, safe, prosperous new year. And join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.